Hello and a warm welcome to another episode of Inside VC, our cool venture capital podcast. And I have the honor to welcome also Christian Leibold again. Hello, Christian. Say hello to the audience.
Hey, hi. Good to be here again.
Yes, and this time we're about to speak about the next generation of venture capital, in this case, next generation VCs, because as one can witness in the German ecosystem, I would say we kind of have a generation shift problem. And Christian and I are this time not alone. To my left and to my right, there are great entrepreneurs and investors by now. Please introduce yourself, starting on the left.
Hi, I'm Olaf Jacobi, one of three partners of Capnamic Ventures. And before I stepped into venture capital, I raised venture capital as an entrepreneur. I've grown and exited three startups, mainly in the tech sector. And in 2007, I changed the sides of the table and became venture capitalist.
You turned to the dark side. What's your age?
48.
48, okay. Christian, what's your age, by the way?
39.
Okay. But you're the one who's longest in the VC game, I guess, right? From
yes, others. Yes, that's because I got in quite early and I probably by now I've been in there for so long that I'm completely unusable for anything else.
Okay, so. I see. And to my right, please introduce yourself.
Yeah, hi. Glad to be here. Philip Dames. I'm one of the founders of Cherry Ventures. Just closed our fund. I came to Berlin 2008 to do my first venture, which failed, a company called Tamundo, a marketplace for collectibles, and then joined the founding team of Zalando and helped build the company and left right before the IPO to focus on investing. Did a bunch of business angel investing also with Cherry, and now we are basically an institutional proper venture capital firm.
It seems that your family is quite like business focused and entrepreneurial background, because I interviewed your brother as well. It's the most over 4,000 people were interested in Foodora and your brother, so I hope we can top that. What's your age?
32.
Okay, so at least we have a level above 30. But as I said, what I witnessed recently is this generation aspect. Yeah, we have quite a few older, more classic VC funds in Germany that actually stopped being active or about in a change in a way where it's yet unclear whether they succeed or not with this generation shift. I mean, guys, what's your view on this, basically?
First of all, the center of gravity is not the venture capitalist in our ecosystem. The center of gravity is the entrepreneur. What we have seen since the bubble bursted in 2000 is that there's a new generation of entrepreneurs out there. Business cases are, let's say, very fast. We are talking about really, let's say, defensible technology coming out of Germany. If the VCs are not adapting with the entrepreneurs, then they are outdated. And I think this is, from a meta perspective, the issue.
Listen, what's your view on this, by the way? I mean, you see the US quite a bit. I learned that France has a problem with this topic. I mean, venture capital in France is a special case because tax-wise, it's really attractive to invest in companies. Yet, from what you told me, this is also a problem over there. Can you give a bigger European picture?
Yeah, I think so. You know, If you look across the key markets like London, you know, and then Paris, which for a long time was very important, and then you know now is coming back, you have a lot of funds that were started in the late 90s. So now, almost 20 years later, it's kind of natural that a lot of those people who started the funds back then are getting into an age where it's about to think about, you know, the next fund generation. And you have to remember, every new fund you do is a 10-year commitment. So once you are maybe in your late 50s or early 60s, do you really want to enter into a new 10-year commitment, and do LPs really want to back you for that period? And I think the challenge is a little bit that a lot of partnerships have worked together for a very long time, which by itself is fantastic, but have failed to bring in new people years ago. And you cannot then, in one moment to the other, manage transition in a fund. It takes years to bring other people into that partnership, allow them to get used to how your firm works, to develop their voice and position, and ultimately bring them to eye level. And I think a lot of people have kind of underestimated the power with which new funds are coming into the market and are creating pressure on some of the established partnerships to change. So now, those folks that over the last 5 years or so haven't brought other people on board, or at least not the kind of people who can now really step up to the plate and work as partners, I think those funds are now all scrambling to hire. And it's a challenge, because you really have to start early. Ideally, you start hiring somebody when you have a fresh fund to invest, as opposed to being at the end of a cycle of a fund and then, you know, thinking about kind of who's going to do the work for the next fund. That's not a good time. And I think that's what happened a little bit to a number of funds.
I was just recently writing an article about one VC that's right now into the generation shift aspect. And when you take a look at the older ones in Germany, like Wellington or Neuhaus Partners, or the one I always forget the name of, Technologiefonds, what's that?
TVM.
TVM, yeah, thank you. It seems they didn't manage to. Olaf, you said something like, today there is less venture capital money in the market than 2005 or something, right?
Yeah, so if we take the BVK figures, market figures from our, let's say, industry association, what we see that the liquid funds, committed capital in German venture capital funds, are still lower than beginning of 2000 or 2005. Why? Because some old, bigger funds, let's say, just disappeared. There's new, fresh fund. Luckily, funds like Cherry Ventures, Power, Capnemic Ventures, Point Nine, we're able to raise new funds so that our market is not totally dried out.
But yet new funds often achieve small amounts of money, as far as I understood, right?
Well, on one hand side, maybe they achieve smaller amounts of committed capital, but sometimes, or even more often, they don't want to raise a 250 million fund because it's rather tough to pay back three times the fund in 10 or 12 years.
Hmm. I mean, I was asking myself, speaking about this aspect with the amount of money in the market being lower than 2005 and all these different players being out of the market by now, did anyone at all manage this generation shift so far in Germany when it comes to venture capital?
There's so it's dead silence.
I mean, I think, you know, well, I think there are two aspects, to be honest. I think one is we're just entering the period where this becomes critical. So I think you can have been perfectly successful by, you know, having a stable team over the last 15 years and not having answered that question, but you're going to have to answer it at some point relatively soon, okay? So I think we should revisit that question maybe in a few years, and then maybe the results are going to look different. I would completely immodestly and arrogantly claim for us that we're doing a decent job at it, simply because, you know, we've brought on a number of people over the last couple of years, and a lot of them as partners. But also, if you look at myself, you know, our firm was started in the late 90s. I joined as an associate. So as a completely clueless guy, I was an engineer, I had no idea about venture capital, and sort of, you know, worked my way up. We believe in an equal partnership as sort of the ultimate goal. And I think we have a couple of cases where we can say people have moved internally, starting all the way at the bottom like me, or also people who have come in later at much more senior positions, but they've moved all the way up to the equal partnership. And so I think that's what we're, you know, quite happy about, that it's worked. But it's something that, you know, didn't work overnight, but it's been a process over many years, really. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think even for us, I mean, we are relatively new in the game, but when we hire someone for the team, in fact, we are already thinking about how can that person develop and will it be someone that can take more responsibility in the next fund. And I think generally, if you look at career paths in VC, you have on the one hand, you have kind of like the, I want to do this for, I don't know, 2-3 years, get the exposure, kind of have exposure to many different deals and industries and aspects of technology. And then I want to move on, start my own business or do something completely different. And I think the other one is the one in Christian's case, someone who joins a firm early on and then does a good job, develops a good track record of investing, and then eventually becomes part of the partnership.
Let's do one step back. Question is, why is a generation shift important? You know, maybe there is a team of three VCs raising a fund, doing one fund generation, and then they will go out of the market. But this is wrong in my perspective. If we see the very successful funds or firms, VC firms in the US, like Sequoia, Kleiner, NEA, Greylock, you name it, all of them have managed successions. And what is the outcome for the ecosystem? It's a very tight network, sometimes 30 years old, through the entire industry. And a young partner can build on this network. And a startup which is venture-backed by this old, let's say, firm with a very tight network, it's like a super-performing Petri dish where the startup, let's say, is put in, and a young fund, a first-time fund, don't normally have this, let's say, very tight network. generation by generation is adding more to this network, and this is really a supportive network for all startups which are venture-backed from this firm. And that's why we need old legacy funds in Germany so that we can, let's say, look into the tail mirror in 20 years and say, wow, okay, we have done a good job and we can support our startup ecosystem.
I mean, I guess you're right. I mean, it's also about experience in a way, right? I think Christian Nagel once told me it costs $50 million to be built up as an investor, as a VC. You said $20 million in 10 years. So somewhere between $20 and $50 million. So it does make sense to keep this knowledge in the market and the connections. Yet I sometimes ask myself, usually from what I learned is, investors are kind of ego machines in a way. At least I witnessed this, that investors often have quite big egos. Is this just something that's superficial and that might be wrong because from an external perspective, or is it true? Because when it comes to generation shifting, it comes to sharing is caring. Yet I often have the impression that investor games are often ego games. Was that wrong?
That's maybe ideally one of the things that are changing a little bit, because it's true that you will find a lot of big egos in venture funds. It's absolutely true. Now, we would probably all claim that we don't have those, and you will never find somebody who tells you he's got a big ego. But if you've ever been to a boardroom in a venture firm, I mean, you know, it's kind of obvious that to some extent it is true. However, I think what's changing a little bit is that as the ecosystem is getting tighter and as people are referencing more and more, and as entrepreneurs start to really have choice as to what VC they want to work for, I think the ego shooter kind of thing becomes a lot more difficult, because you put yourself in a box where maybe at some point entrepreneurs who have a choice don't want to work with you anymore. And you always have to remember that we are hunting for what we believe are the biggest, best deals. And so we like situations where entrepreneurs have choice, because that probably means they're good entrepreneurs. We have to be referenceable and not come across as people who are, you know, condescending or kind of always know everything better, because that's going to make it hard for us to get that one deal where an entrepreneur does have several term sheets. So hopefully it's changing a little bit as the ecosystem is maturing. And I think that's definitely a good development. The one thing that is maybe a little positive about the ego is sometimes an entrepreneur needs somebody who really places a gutsy bet. And sometimes people who have a strong ego and believe in what they see is okay, even if everybody around them tells them your idea is wrong, then maybe sometimes that's actually also positive, or that's maybe one of the reasons why you have a lot of those egos among VCs. But I think as a behavioral trait, it's definitely losing proposition over the long term and not so prevalent anymore.
Funnily, you just said an entrepreneur is able to choose for which investor he is going to work for.
Isn't not it going to work for, but you know, who he wants to take funding from or work with.
Because I was about to say, isn't it actually the other way around, at least at the same level, yeah, investors and entrepreneurs?
No, absolutely. If the choice is with the entrepreneur, which, you know, again, in a good situation it is, absolutely. I think that's another aspect where you, as a VC, we always say we are salespeople for money, right? At the end of the day, we're selling money, and we're selling it by telling the entrepreneur, here's what comes with the money, right? Those are the things we can help you with. And that's why every VC has a different angle at that. And that's good, because that way it can be complementary when you invest together. But that's how it has to work.
How about Cherry, by the way? Did you think about all these strategic aspects when you started your fund? Or was it, you know, you might have also go to a VC, say, hey, I'm doing this for 2 to 3 years, then raise my own fund as others do. Was this an option, or didn't think about it at all?
No, we didn't really think about doing that, because we'd already invested quite a lot with our first small fund as business angels, and we thought about many different ways of professionalizing our investment activity. And I think what we saw as well, what Christian just said, is that the ecosystem is somewhat maturing, in a sense that, you know, entrepreneurs tend to have a choice today in terms of who they want to be working with. And for us also, as entrepreneurs pitching to VCs, we kind of saw a similar development, that on the one hand, we have all these great entrepreneurs in the market that have global ambitions. It's no longer only, you know, copy-paste execution models, but it's actually innovative business models that are emerging here in Berlin. And at the same time, the VC landscape has, yeah, at least to some extent, not really caught up with that development. And for us, we said, okay, let's try and build a firm that's truly entrepreneur focused, and where we can leverage our operational experience to an extent. And obviously we haven't had 20-year VC heritage, but we've made some learnings with our first investments. And on the other hand, I think we've talked to pretty much everybody in the industry in terms of what's important when you're building this. And I think even for us at an early stage, we think about stuff like, you know, generation change and what's the right strategy. So it's not that we woke up one morning and said, hey, let's build Cherry, but it's actually something that we've planned for a relatively long period of time.
Maybe what Philip doesn't say is, you know, he pitched us when he was doing Tamundo, his first company, and maybe it was so terrible that already in that very moment he decided he had to do his own VC at some point. I don't know.
I didn't know you remember. But,
yeah. I do remember the meeting in Hamburg.
Famous meeting
absolutely.
In Hamburg, yeah.
Yes. Is it like with lawyers? When you speak to a lawyer, like the Big Five or the Big Ten, they know all of the companies and either work with them right now or used to work for them in the past. Is it with the VCs the same thing, that you work with someone else or with the company over the time, no matter what you do? Is it a tight network where everyone knows each other?
I mean, among VCs, I would say yes. With the entrepreneurs, it's become so big now that, you know, maybe if you're really focused on one geography, you kind of still know everybody, but across Europe, no way.
I think for us it's more like that, because I think we're a bit more local, right. We're more early stage, and we tend to be on the ground a lot here. So I think Berlin is a big ecosystem. At the same time, it's a super small ecosystem, right? So because
I get the impression that there are groups in a way. I can remember there was the Team Europe group with Lukas Kolja and their combo. You have the Rocket group, then you had the SoundCloud Christoph Mehr group, and then it appeared that you had these different groups, and they're doing all the deals within. You don't share my opinion.
Absolutely not. Let's have a look on the German startup ecosystem. We have counted this, and we've double-checked this with Hightech Gründerfonds, with other early-stage funds. And no life science, no biotech. We are talking about between 2,000 and 2,300 deals a year. Pitch decks, which are flowing around, teams trying to get business angel funding or venture capital funding, mainly venture capital funding. 30% of all deals are coming out of Berlin. 30%. Including e-commerce, execution games, you name it. If you drill it down to pure tech deals, say technology deals, it's about 20% out of Berlin. The rest is Hamburg, Cologne, Munich, Karlsruhe, Dresden, Leipzig, Stuttgart. So we don't have today, we don't have this mega cluster. Berlin has a huge impact. And it's growing. It's just the beginning. Let's see what will happen in 10 years. Maybe it will become the mega cluster in Germany. But currently, the entire German ecosystem is spread out, I would say, into 5 or 6 clusters in Germany.
Yeah, but if you take a look at the numbers of companies being found, that might be true. But if you take a look at revenue, for instance, or exit money, I mean, I would say that the biggest exit happened in Berlin so far.
No. Take TeamViewer.
Yeah, I thought about TeamViewer as well.
Or take Hybris. Take Astaro in Karlsruhe. There are some hidden exits you never have written about or you never had heard about. So that's definitely not true.
Yeah, but on the other hand, I think Berlin is a magnet in a
Absolutely.
Sense. So look at also not only Germany, but look at Europe. Look at how London is looking at Berlin currently, how Eastern Europe is looking at Berlin. Everybody is moving here. I think this city has the best kind of setup for becoming really one of the, if not the most important startup hub in Europe.
Absolutely. I was sitting in a conference of one of my former investors, LPs, you know, investing in venture funds in New York. And there was a panel discussion, and there was a senior partner of Union Square. And the discussion was about Silicon Valley, New York, or San Francisco. And this guy said, well, it's the urbanization of technology. People want to work where they want to live. It's Berlin, London, New York, San Francisco. He counted Berlin first, yeah? And in the entire room, I was the only German guy. So there were only US guys. So absolutely true, Berlin will become even bigger than today in terms of, you know, the startup ecosystem. But we shouldn't forget all the other tech clusters in Germany.
I think it depends a little bit on your focus too. If you're really looking in you know, real tech, it's probably even more distributed than if you're looking at consumer internet and software. I think consumer internet software, also the stuff, you know, that people talk about, and ultimately also the companies that employ a lot of people, because they tend to have customer support and all of that, they definitely have you know, a strong concentration, a growing concentration, I would say, in Berlin.
Maybe one last aspect before we dive into what characteristic form a next generation VC. How about carry? What I learned so far is that quite a few generation shifts won't work because of carry. When I wrote the book about the Sumvers, I was speaking to one guy who accompanied them during the Elando time, and he said the problem was the investors would have needed to make the Sumvers rich. They didn't have any money at that time, at least not the super rich way they are right now, and it would have helped them to continue the eBay game if they were rich, if someone was able to give them like 1 million, 2 million, 10 million or something like that. Is this something that happens in the VC space as well, that if a partner has a certain amount of money on his bank account and isn't so focused on carry, that this makes a difference in generation shifts?
Well, I think, first of all, let's talk about the business case of a VC. There are two components. It's management fee and carry. Carry is the most important. A VC will earn carry if he is doing good investments and good exits. Exits are most important because only with an exit, money will come back to the fund and will distribute it to the fund investors. So carry is the key. Well, there are some theses in the market why generation shift or the generation change is rather complicated if a fund or a firm is not well performing, because maybe this is a thesis in the market, the old partners don't want to share because they are not rich enough to share. So, but if you have 100 or 200 million, or if it's a real big fund, 300 million venture capital fund, and you have earned carry, you can't care less about generation shift. So this is one thesis why maybe some funds are struggling.
What's your view on this, Christian? Does this make sense?
Yeah, no, I think that makes a lot of sense. I think also there are two other things to keep in mind. I think, first of all, if you've built a firm where you really think, you know, that has become a platform, you really want to make sure it stays around. You don't want to see it close its doors when you kind of leave the office. So I think people start putting real effort into it. And I think another important element is that if you have a firm that's performing strongly, it just makes it a lot easier for you to hire great people. When you hire great people, it makes it a lot easier for you probably to let go. I think that is a positive effect that makes it quite feasible for firms that are doing well to just attract top talent. And on the flip side, makes it hard for firms that have built a track record that will make it difficult for them to raise a new fund to attract great people, because they will always see the risk of not being able to raise another fund. And so it just becomes a lot harder than if you've, you know, a great performance and got a great performance under your belt.
I mean, help us understand one thing. If the thesis is as soon as a investor is rich enough, he's willing to share, how much does an investor earn? Are they really rich, or is it like in between? Like, just give us an idea. Because I'm asking myself, is there someone who became a multimillionaire by doing investments? And that's rather rare.
In the United States, you have venture capital investors, which are,
of course,
you know, more than millionaires. But I think none of us, and I would say the majority in the German venture capital market, is doing this because they want to get rich. I think you have to have fun to do this. And if an entrepreneur is talking to an investor, and the entrepreneur will feel and will recognize if he is doing this because he really likes to support startups and to invest or not. Sure, there's a business case. And at the end, we are, the majority of the money we are investing is money from our investors, from pension funds, from corporates, you name it. And they want to get back a multiple and a good return. And that's why we have to generate money. So, and if we generate money, we will earn money.
Perfectly makes sense. But are investors like rich usually?
Normally you have to be somehow rich in order to become a venture capitalist, because you have to invest in your fund, your own money.
But it depends, you know. The thing is, like, the fund cycles are very long, right? So I think if you do a good job as an investor, you can absolutely become rich. Absolutely. I think, however, it just takes long, because fund cycles are long. It is probably less risky than doing a single investment in, or, you know, putting all your eggs in one basket, as people say, which is becoming an entrepreneur, right? Since you don't have the luxury of diversifying if you're an entrepreneur. So it, I think, is probably less risky. It's probably let's say, less extreme in a way, right? But of course, you know, it takes longer. And so maybe actually it taking longer makes it very risky again, because there are a lot of things that can go wrong over time.
Philip doesn't share your opinion.
I don't know. I think at the end it comes down to what do you want to achieve. Do you want to build a firm that's there to stay? Do you want to build a brand also at the end of the day that's in some way also differentiated in the market? When we decided to do Cherry, we realized obviously it's a very, very long commitment. It's not 10 years, but usually it's much more than that, because, you know, after the investment period, you start raising another fund, then the new fund's 10 years again. So you're in this for a very long time. And at the end, if we wanted to build something that's, you know, Christian, Daniel and Philip, it would have been like a completely different motivation than building a firm and building Cherry, which we hope will be there for generations, hopefully. Yeah. So I think at the end of the day, yes, of course, everybody wants to build big companies, because big companies mean great returns for your investors and eventually also mean carry. But at the end of the day, it's I think more of a, you know, mindset with which you start.
I mean, ideally this is the last job you ever do. So I've been doing this for 14 years. I don't think I'm going to do, you know, a different job anymore. So I agree with that 100%. But Philip, to be honest, at the same time, you won't have given your investors terms where you don't take carry, right? Of course.
Yeah, sure.
The economics are part of the game. That, again, is necessary, because that's how you attract great people, right?
I think if you want to optimize your return as an investor and you're in the situation where you can invest personally, then I think this is probably the more straightforward way to do so, because you can be more flexible. You don't really have to think about fund economics. You can do a small ticket left and right. So I think it's a very different game investing as a business angel than investing as a VC.
Mm-hmm. The other interesting thing that people often quote in this context is that, you know, you spend as much time on an investment in a company where you deploy $1 million in an early stage company. And, you know, there's a lot of questions still, as, you know, somebody might spend on investing $10 million in a later stage company, where there's a different set of questions and, you know, you have a more profound due diligence process. But at the end of the day, in terms of the partner's time, it may be quite similar. However, of course, the carried interest on a $10 million investment is going to be 10x that of a $1 million investment, assuming the same multiple, right? So, of course, people who really want to make money typically move up the ladder to private equity or, you know, later stage funds, because sometimes the economics are more attractive than in early stage.
Let's dive into the characteristics of next generation VC then. I mean, interestingly, we have different generations right here. Starting with you, Philip, what would you say is the typical aspect of a next generation VC? What differs from these first time funds that started and renewed the business right now?
I think it's a bit in how they see the entrepreneur. Realizing that there's a number of funds in the market, I think you said it, there's less capital in the market, but on the other hand, I think we would all agree that, especially in the early stage, there's increasing competition between funds, but also more professional business angels. So I think it's really important to think about, okay, how do you differentiate? What do you do differently than others? And how can you, at the end of the day, convince the entrepreneur to work with you? I think that's something that might not have been part so much of the thinking of like more traditional VCs. And for us, it's really to work with the entrepreneur on eye level, trying to build something together rather than, you know, meeting every couple of months for a board meeting and screaming if the numbers go in the wrong direction. But it's more of a, we are in this together. We will be in this for a long time. And it's very much, you know, a sparring on eye level rather than, you know, a investors up here, entrepreneur down here, kind of relationship. So I'm not saying all the VCs had that type of approach, but I think the tendency goes very much to put the entrepreneur first. And I think a lot of new funds, but also some of the more traditional funds that are changing a bit their structure, are reacting to the trend that the entrepreneur is in the center of everything and actually gets to choose who he wants to work with.
But I mean, this is not really a defendable position in a way, right? I mean, is this all that's to next generation VCs? Because easily, I mean, all of the VCs would say, hey, we're entrepreneurial focused.
Yeah, but at the end, it's very much also a clear positioning. Yeah? And this can be in the case of Point 9 that they do this, you know, with the stronger focused on SaaS and marketplaces. It can be like us, more consumer technology with a bit more local focus on Berlin. It can be the international exposure of a fund like eVentures. So I think it's very much also the same way we look at startups and ask, what's your USP? The entrepreneur will look at us and go, okay, what's your USP really? So if a project A can say we can leverage our BI support or online marketing, that's one way of doing it. The way Point9 is doing is another one. So I think at the end of the day, you need to have one. Otherwise, you know, just part of the noise.
The market is professionalizing. It's not more about just providing capital. It's about providing capital with a certain twist, let's call it that. So I think it's just a, you know, the maturity that's coming into the market with more players that each carve out, you know, their clear positioning. And that is very beneficial for the entrepreneur because you're no longer just looking for money. And, you know, there is a number of VCs, relatively small number, and, you know, they're kind of all undifferentiated. You can try to find one that probably fits your need. And then hopefully as an entrepreneur, also the likelihood that you find somebody who you like, who shares some of your experience, who you can work with, and who's going to want to back you is higher because there is just a bigger overlap than if you have sort of more, let's say, general purpose capital, as maybe to some extent historically has been the case.
In terms of next generation VC, what's the meaning behind? It's a mindset and it's an approach. And Philip already mentioned this eye level, and I think we can't repeat this enough. The eye level approach between investor and founding team and entrepreneur, I think it's key because the entrepreneur is not going to a bank and asking for a loan. The entrepreneur is looking for a partner. Money is easy. A good team will get money. As I've said, the center of gravity is the founder, is the entrepreneur. If there is no VC in the market, a good team with a good case will get money from wherever. If there are no VCs, the ecosystem will somehow survive. So we are not the center. That means we are acting as a supporting factor or supporting part to the founder and with the founder. After we have done our due diligence, which sometimes is tough, we are partners. And we wake up in the morning and the first thing we are doing is thinking about how we can support our startups at the end in order to pay back the money to our investors. But it's a supporting job, mainly HR and business development. And this is a real big difference. I have raised, as an entrepreneur, I think 6 venture rounds from, I would say, first-time VCs. And how I have worked with them is totally, totally different how entrepreneurs can work, if they pick the right one, with VCs today. Why? Because more and more VCs have entrepreneurial background and experience. And if you have had the situation when you wake up at night sweating because you know in 2 weeks is cash out. As an entrepreneur, you know what it feels like. If you haven't been in this situation, well, you can't understand the founder. And that doesn't mean that every partner and every team member of a VC has to have this experience. But if you have 10 people, it's really good to have 5 with entrepreneurial background in a VC firm, so that the entire team is really understanding the founder and can support the founder.
What you just mentioned, this being on one level, like this eye level aspect, I would think that this is something normal, something I would expect from every VC and not only a next generation VC.
Definitely not.
This is shocking in a way, isn't it? From a founder's perspective, it is.
It's also a question of supply and demand. Huh? It used to take, you know, a couple of weeks to get a meeting at a VC. And obviously that's, you know, now drawing an extreme picture. And now you have, you know, 4 in the radius of 5 kilometers. I think the game is changing a lot. And I think also for the entrepreneur, it's so much more fun to deal with someone that kind of understands what you're talking about. And it's not that you do the first meeting. I remember, you know, those pitch meetings. It's like you have a first meeting, then nothing, then 2 weeks later you have a second one, you do the exact same pitch again to a different group of people, then nothing, then a third week goes by, then you get some questions via email, and it's like this process that kind of drives you crazy in an entrepreneur. And I'm not saying that's the case today. Also not, you know, with first generation VC, I'm not sure if I actually like this term, but it's just something that's simply not acceptable today. And I think you will simply not get into very good deals if you behave in a way like this.
There's a nice story. I won't tell the name. It's not a German funded. One of my, let's say, ex-founders was on fundraising for the B round and had a meeting with the VC, partner meeting, all partners. So the meeting was scheduled for, let's say, 2 p.m. He was waiting half an hour. At 2:30, all of the partners were in the room and the associates as well. The main partner, you know, the gray eminence, if this is not too much Germanism, showed up 10 minutes late, didn't pay attention, checking emails on his laptop, not on his BlackBerry or iPhone. So, and this founder, the CEO of the company, Berlin-based company, after 15 minutes, he just closed his laptop and said, well, I think this meeting won't make sense anymore. Goodbye. It's the only thing you can do. So I think it has to do with respect. Yeah? And this is very drastic, the scene, yeah? Or the scenario. But I've heard a lot of stories like this.
But on the other hand, let's be honest, it's not going to be the main differentiation of the fund to be punctual to meetings. I think this is becoming hygiene factors, and we are in a great situations for founders today because there is, you know, availability of capital in the markets. And but I think the differentiation needs to go beyond that.
Yeah, but I disagree. We are not in a great situation for founders in terms of how much capital is in the market. I think we have more cases, interesting cases in Germany compared with the money which we can invest. So if we take the European average, we are still undercapitalized. We are below European average. Finland is on top one, followed by UK, and even Spain has more, you know, more money to invest compared with the gross income of the country. So I think there's enough, let's say, room to be filled in the venture capital industry in Germany.
But nail it down a bit. I mean, this is rather fluffy, yeah, saying next generation VC is about treating entrepreneurs equally, and that's respecting them and argumenting on eye level. That's so far what I learned from being a next generation VC.
No, that's not everything. Philip and Christian already mentioned this. It's about positioning, and it's not about a totally, and this was true in the past for some VCs, a totally, purely opportunistic investment approach, sitting at the desk in your office, waiting that the founding team is ringing the doorbell and asking for money. No, today you really have to work on your network in order to find the right teams and the right cases. So if you're a little bit more in the market as a VC, at the end, your network is better and you can support the startups even more.
I mean, I think, yeah, that's an important point, and it's certainly something that has been pioneered by Andreessen in the US, I think, where, you know, VCs, for example, are starting to build operational capabilities as well, right? So you have some VCs that have teams dedicated to supporting the companies in areas that are sort of, you know, applicable to most of the portfolio companies. So HR is a typical one, or in our case, for example, is online marketing, right? So we have, his office is next to us here, Louis Hahnemann, who used to be the CMO at Rocket. So his job is to support companies in online marketing and helping them grow, especially internationally, right? Because that's what he's done before. So, you know, that's one specific thing that we're doing, which fits with our positioning of, you know, helping companies go international. But other people do different things. And so ideally, as an entrepreneur, you can build yourself a syndicate where maybe you get people around the table who have different areas of expertise.
Right? By the way, just one small question on this operational VC approach. I think it's really expensive in a way. So your burn rate, yes, turns up. And I mean, as a VC, you have the problem. You do an investment and 4 to 7 years later, the money comes in basically.
No, so it's something that you can only do once you have a certain level of assets under management, essentially, because you have enough management fee to finance these type of people. Or that's the other thing, and that comes back to the business model. If you're a VC that has a strong track record and where people have made carry, then, you know, a lot of the partners can actually say, we're happy to take a very low salary and invest rather in people who help us make our portfolio better and therefore our return stronger, which again, at the end of the day, is going to result in better fund performance and more carry. So it's a long-term game, but you can really only play it and pay these resources if you have sort of, you know, a critical mass already that, you know, typically involves several fund generations.
Okay, so we have entrepreneurial mindset, treating each other on an eye level, having a clear position. How about other VCs, by the way? I mean, this eye level aspect, does this also count when it comes to VC rounds, where you obviously need co-investors quite often? Is this also something that's different in next generation VCs than first time VCs?
I think, look, this whole like new gen, old gen kind of thought, I think at the end, it comes down to will you make successful investments? And there's, you know, like look at Holzbring as a good example of a fund that's been around for a while and has been doing a great job in terms of, you know, their fund performance. For us, it's really, you know, I think it's we're taking a bit of a different approach. We're trying to change something. We're trying to build something new, but we also have to prove ourselves. And I think at the end of the day, you will only prove yourself by making good deals. And that usually involves, you know, also being able to partner with other VCs and get a company to a level where they can raise a much bigger round than the money that we can invest. Yeah? And there, I think VC is very different from private equity. It's very much focused on partnerships and working together with the number of people that you trust and building a network, not only for references, not only for cross-checks on business models, but at the end of the day, also for co-investment opportunities.
I think this is a very important point here. The syndicates and the, let's say, the how VCs are working together. And if we look back 15 years, early 2000, we have had maybe five or six VC firms in 2003, 2004, yeah, with capital. The likelihood of a syndication from the very first beginning, from the initial investment, was rather low. Today, if we are meeting together at a conference, so we are exchanging really deals and talking about deals. It's more a cooperative approach than a, well, I want to hide my next big thing or something like this, because sometimes or most often it makes really sense to step into a syndicate from the very first beginning with two or three investors, because what Christian mentioned, all of them bring different things or experiences onto the table in order to support the startup. And this is a big differentiator and is rather new in Germany compared with the United States, for example.
Yeah, I was about to ask about access to deal flow in a way. How does this happen? Usually, investors are super well informed. I guess it's probably a lot about the network in a way. But I also tend to ask myself, how does this happen? If a founder speaks to one guy, it's usually not enough. As you guys said, there's not enough VC in the market. And it's not the case that a founder has like four term sheets on the table and just needs to choose. So basically, I guess quite often happens that he needs to talk to different people. How do you guys act with this? I mean, this whole deal flow thing, how does it work basically?
Well, there is pure proprietary deal flow, but this is very, very rare. Pure proprietary deal flow, that means it's more a family tree deal, like in my example, Dedrone. Maybe you have heard about the company. The two founders, two of the three founders, were co-founders of myself. So they came to me and said, Olaf, this is our new idea. Okay, here's the money. So no other VC has seen this case. This is very rare. And then you have a normal proprietary deal flow, means a team you have met and they have met Cherry and eVentures and they are approaching maybe two or three VCs, not more. And then they have the dear madam and sir venture capitalist, here's my pitch deck. But this is the incoming, let's say, deal flow. But then if there's an interesting case on the table, as a VC, you start thinking, well, should I do this alone? Or would it make sense to, let's say, to invite one of my, let's say, my partners from a different venture firm to say, well, have a look, what do you think? Should we do this together or should we ask a third one as well? And this is happening more often than in the past.
Give us some advice. If a young founder goes to a VC, what is he supposed to do? I mean, obviously, we learned do not do this mass email stuff thing with just sorry, dear madam. But I had the impression that it's sometimes hard to be in this exact window, right? Not too many VCs that you feel like a VC prostitute. As far as I know, VCs start to talk. And yet not too few that if one says no, basically your round is screwed up in a way. So what's the ideal way of dealing here? Because I also tend to ask myself, if I approach to Christian my idea, will he call Olaf and say, hey, I got this guy on the phone just recently. He said this and that. What do you think about it? Is this benchmarking happen?
Normally, you should approach. When I was a founder, at first, I have approached the B list. Only some guys from the B list, in order to learn my pitch and to learn the reaction. And after I've done two or three meetings with B list VCs, which I not normally wouldn't work with, well, then I approach the A list. Maybe four, not more. This is one approach. There are many approaches.
Tap into your network first as an entrepreneur. Yeah. So see, where can I get a good introduction? And it doesn't really matter to what firm it is, but never write an email to team@xyz and say, okay, here I am. I think we, as you said, there's hundreds of deals, and I don't remember a single case where we actually ended up investing in a company that's just in a general pitch. We look at all of them, but at the end, it's also somewhat of a, you know, try and get a warm intro, like try and get a little bit closer to the people, because at the end of the day, that's also the people that you will be working with as an entrepreneur. And look on LinkedIn, who can connect you. And I'm sure through, you know, two corners, everyone can kind of get a direct intro to an investor. And I think that's super important, because at the end of the day, it's a people's business. And if you, as an entrepreneur, have you make the impression that you're shopping your idea around to everyone, then eventually also it will look less appealing to an investor.
I mean, I think there are too many deals for us to sort of always pick up the phone and say, oh, you know, I just talked to this and have you looked at that? There's just too much going on. And at the same time, you know, there are not that many VCs that, you know, you could say I'm approaching 50 or so. You can do that in the Valley, but here I think the risk of spreading to everybody is somewhat limited, because if you do a good job at only pitching VCs that are actually relevant in the sense of they invest in your stage, in your sector and so on, the number is not going to be huge. I think the one thing that some people do is, you know, they brag about who they are talking to and they tell you like, oh, yes, we're very far in the process with investor XYZ, right? Then, of course, you call that guy and you say, hey, I heard you're going to put a term sheet down on these guys next week. And then he says, hang on a minute, you know, I just took a meeting and I thought we were going to pass. Then that really, you know, doesn't help the credibility. So that's the one thing, you know, don't oversell who you have relationships with, who you're talking to, because then if that's not true, you know, that's something that's going to be very easy for us to validate. Yeah.
So this next generation VC mindset, yeah, let's call it a mindset. Maybe you're right, it doesn't make sense to divide between old guys and new guys, because it's basically about a mindset. Does this mean consequently that this next generation mindset leads to more cooperation between investors as well?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And just you see more syndicates. You see more rounds where, you know, we would invest together with one or two other VCs. And I think that's, you know, the sign of that.
And it's not only on the deal-making side where the investment professionals are talking to each other. What's happening now is that amongst young VC firms, you know, the so-called CFOs or the guys from, you know, from the back office are meeting and exchanging best practices. So the communication and the cooperation amongst all the new VC funds is very tight, and it's good for the industry, because, as I've said, sharing best practices or no-goes is makes sense.
Cool. Did we forget anything about Next Generation VC?
I think that's it.
Okay. If four brains say that's all about Next Generation VC, I have to thank all of you guys. Thanks for taking the time. It was fun to have all the different generations here. Thanks, Christian, for being with me all the time. And see you next time.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Been a pleasure.